could be sweeter than a tweety when I meet her in the morning.
The morning.
With the morning glory.
The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, I'm Joe Simpson for the North Carolina Reading Service. Welcome to Triangle Yesteryear. On this program, you will hear reminiscences of life around North Carolina's Triangle area in earlier times, written by local authors. On today's program, we're going to head a little bit south of the Triangle to read some excerpts from Country Matters by Jo Northrup. In the introduction to her book, Jo writes, "Country Matters is my attempt to share my experiences, joys and sorrows, laughter and tears with others who believe, or may come to believe, how much the country matters. I've seen a fair amount of the world, met some interesting people, done interesting things, and loved deeply. This I want to share. I also want to share my two perspectives, that of a very active woman with 20/20 vision, then, after I became legally blind in 1976, that of a visually impaired and still active woman. If it's possible that losing one sense means your others are intensified, then I bring that to some of these pieces. Earlier in my life, details of a countryside were vividly graphic, but since the time of impaired vision, things are clearest in peephole focus, and the rest of the world is a wonderful impressionistic painting. Perhaps this altered reality has given me an inner vision that was not always mine. This book is about the country, the natural world, and how much it has meant, and still means, to me. Fragments from my childhood in the country, the times when my dreams were shaped, swirl together with the memories of so many other country homes." On with the book. Scenes from Childhood. Sandspurs, doodlebugs, and free-fall recall. The round-faced 3-year-old girl in the photograph wears striped coveralls with brass snaps down the front. Hands jammed in her pockets, she's leaning against a brick wall and smiling the smile of childhood. I remember the day my mother took that picture. It was shortly after we moved to our big 2-story white farmhouse in Hoke County, North Carolina, and I was playing alone in the backyard. I loved my coveralls, the house that seemed so big to me, and the spacious grounds. The country house had many rooms, a big front porch, a small screened-in back porch, and a long screened sleeping porch. Porches that were half enclosed and half screened, where you could sleep on cots on very hot nights, were once common in the South. I could ride my tricycle on the front porch in good weather, and on the sleeping porch when it was rainy. The house had hidey holes, dark closets, and doors to hide behind when playing hide-and-go-seek. There was a big pecan tree in the backyard, from which a rope swing hung. I would swing there for hours, where my mother could keep an eye on me from the kitchen. As a child growing up in the country, I had a special awareness of the land. I grew up in the days when no one locked their doors, not even when going on vacation. We knew everyone in our part of the country. We were dutifully warned by our parents never to get into a car with a stranger, but few strangers came around. I couldn't always have friends over to play, because friends often lived quite a few miles away, and special plans had to be made to get together. Later, when I was big enough to ride a bike, I could pedal to a neighboring farm to play with the children there. I believe that children who grow up in the country learn to amuse themselves and become independent early, and they have more freedom because there are fewer distractions. I remember lying on my belly in a field of grass and watching one patch of ground to see how many insects I could count. Over a period of time, there were red ants, tiny black beetles, sometimes a slim green worm on a blade of grass, and once in a while, the special delight of a ladybug or a grasshopper. Some grasshoppers, when caught, would spit on me. From going barefoot, I knew where the prickly sandspur plants were thickest. I'd choose another path to wherever I was headed, because pulling a sandspur out of bare feet is painful. I knew that the catbirds nested in the roses that thickly covered a wire fence in the backyard. I knew that I was to stay well back from their nest, so I wouldn't frighten the mother bird. And I was never, ever supposed to touch the nest or eggs. It was a sore temptation. Although I would hurry by the catbird's nest, many's the time the nesting mother flew off her nest and sailed toward me, fussing and scolding. I knew where powdery ant hills, like tiny mountains, rose up from the sandy soil. Sometimes I'd accidentally step on an ant hill, and the angry little ants would swarm over my feet and legs. But a country kid knows you just brush them off with your hand. We had bobwhite quail on our land, and I knew the time of year when they hatched. We'd sit on the porch and watch the beautiful little hen lead her brood across the lawn, the chicks looking like tiny powder puffs. I knew that the guineas made their nests and laid their hard, speckled eggs in the blackberry brambles at the edge of the thicket. If we wanted to gather any of the guinea eggs, they had to be removed from the nest with a long-handled spoon, because the guineas would abandon the nest if they smelled human scent. In spring, just before nesting, the male guinea would puff his feathers up and attack anything that annoyed him, including dogs and automobiles. We lost a number of guineas on the road each year when they bowed up and rushed at an oncoming car. Growing up in the country, I knew when it was time to plant a garden, and begged for permission to plant radishes of my own. They came up quickly, and I loved pulling the tiny red radishes from the ground and taking a bunch to my mother. Summers were hot, and time seemed to be in slow motion. I loved the water, and went swimming in any creek, lake, or pond when allowed. I was a true water rat. Because those days were safer, I could walk in the woods by myself at any time of year. I had to tell my mother where I was going, of course, and be home when she told me to. As a kid, I didn't have a watch, but I could guess the time by the height of the sun. I knew the best places to pick violets in spring, and where the wild arbutus grew, and where to find deep green ground moss. I knew that in the fall our grapes would ripen, and pecans would fall from the trees in our yard. We would leave a bushel basket under a pecan tree, and people who happened by could pick up some of the nuts and put them in the basket. Before long, we'd have a bushel full. Friends came to get pecans before the holidays, and I remember going with my mother to help them fill their baskets. In the winter, we'd sit by the fire and crack the nuts and pick out nut meats, so there'd be plenty for candy, cakes, and pies, and for salted and sugared nuts. I still like plain pecans, right out of the shell. I loved running barefoot down a freshly plowed furrow at harvest time, and loved seeing a field of cotton when it was ready for picking. I loved riding my bicycle on the sandy road beside our house. But when the sun started down and the bull bats swooped over the lane, I knew it was time to go home. Growing up in the country, with horses and mules in the barn, I knew which ones would kick the stall and which were gentle. I learned to shuck dry corn, but didn't like going into the corn crib, because sometimes a black snake, in search of mice, would slither under the pile of corn. I climbed the oak and sassafras trees in the thicket, and built a playhouse in their shade. I'd push my feet under the sand in a ditch, and carefully withdraw them, leaving two little caves. These were roadhouses. I knew where the wasps made their papery nests under the eaves of the tobacco pack house. I was wary of the places where rattlesnakes might be. My father told me that the cottonmouth water moccasin favors the shoreline of lake, river, and creek, and that on land you'll rarely see one more than 2 feet above the level of the water. Of special interest was how the doodlebugs dug their conical houses in the sand. I could make the funny-looking little antlion come to the surface by blowing in its sandy lair, or by stirring it gently with a straw while chanting, "Doodlebug, doodlebug, your house is on fire." When the big black and yellow butterflies, and the orange ones, and the little white ones, fluttered over the larkspur and yellow daisies that ran wild in the side yard, I'd sit among the flowers and hope for a butterfly to light on my head. None ever did, but when I held a bunch of flowers in my hand, the butterflies would hover over them. As a child growing up in the country, I knew the bumps and gullies, the trees and shrubs, the woods and wildlife on the land, because I was outside so much and paying attention to nature in the way that some children do. Even today, when I happen to crush a weed underfoot and catch its smell, or see larkspur blooming, or see people stooping, basket in hand, under a pecan tree, my senses whirl me back to a time and place that was so totally familiar. Child's Play. Earlier in the day, I heard the faint sound of children playing at the new school down the road. Their lively shouting and laughing is an unmistakable international sound, and today it stirs childhood memories of my country grammar school and the games we played in the schoolyard. Many of the games children play are part of our folk heritage. New games are invented as times change, but some of the old ones remain. Hopscotch, tag, and hide-and-go-seek come to mind, as well as ball games of all kinds. Today, manufactured balls and bats are readily available, but there was a time when country kids had to make their own. String or rubber balls were made of a stone center wound with twine or thin strips of inner tubing. Bats were hand-turned on a lathe or carved roughly by hand. If there were too few children for a regulation game of baseball, we would play One-Eyed Cat, a game that requires a batter, catcher, pitcher, and fielders, but only one base and home plate. The batter either strikes out, three strikes, or gets a hit. He can be caught out or tagged as he runs from home to the base and back. If he's declared out, the player who put him out goes to bat. If he strikes out, he goes to the field. The pitcher becomes the catcher goes to bat, and the game resumes. The batter continues as long as he is not put out. The game may no longer be called One-Eyed Cat, but I'll wager that school children are playing some version of it today. During recess at most country schools, lively contests of jacks and marbles would take place, and the seesaw was usually in motion. We also jumped the board. Two players were needed for that. A game that called for placing a long, strong, but flexible plank across a log. To make this simple setup work, we had to position the lumber according to the weight of the jumpers. When we were ready to go, the child on the end that was elevated leapt up and landed on the plank, bringing it down and catapulting the other player in the air. This up-and-down frolicking continued until one of the jumpers missed the board and landed on the ground. Then it was someone else's turn. Though the game sounds dangerous, I don't remember anyone ever getting hurt. We had a sandy playground, and it certainly was fun. We also played a wacky form of charades, a very old game called Bum Bum Bum. For this bit of nonsense, we didn't keep score, you first divide the gang into two teams. One side decides on an occupation, such as a farmer tossing hay, while the other one lines up and waits. While approaching their opponents, the actors chant, "Bum, bum, bum, here we come, all the way from Washington." The other crew answers, "Where are you from?" "Pretty Girl Station," is the reply. "What's your occupation?" the opposing team demands. The last retort becomes a signal for the entire team to act out their chosen occupation. What a crazy scene! When someone figures out the answer, the groups swap sides, and the guessers become the actors. One of my favorite schoolyard activities was jumping rope. While two girls turned the old plow line, we hopped to sing-song verses until a misstep gave someone else a chance. My favorite old jump rope ditty. Teddy bear, turn around. Teddy bear, touch the ground. Teddy bear, climb the stairs. Teddy bear, say your prayers. Teddy bear, switch off the light. Teddy bear, say good night. Many other games have been handed down over the years. Red Rover, Crack the Whip, Farmer in the Dell, and Drop the Handkerchief are a few that I recall. It's good to remember these old outdoor games, for they're a colorful part of country lore. A Carolina Country Christmas. When I was a child, the spicy fragrance of mince pie that mingled with the pungent pine scent of burning fatwood meant things were astir in the kitchen on Christmas morning. Those rich smells floating upstairs, the thump of firewood thrown on the back porch, and the muffled clatter coming from the kitchen, sent us children scampering from the warmth of our quilt-covered beds. We hurried by the garlanded banister, dashing across the drafty hall into the living room, where the kindling urged along a gently hissing fire. On the hearth was a collection of small boxes and baskets set out by each of us on Christmas Eve. Santa Claus had a choice of chimneys at our North Carolina farmhouse, but we knew he always came down the one in the living room, because that's where we had the tree. Even when Father's preference was favored, and the tree was put in the wide hall by the front windows, Santa still came down the living room chimney. He filled each box and basket with hard candies, chocolate drops, gummy bears, gumdrops, peppermint sticks, and ribbon candy, as well as walnuts, pecans, almonds, chestnuts, Brazil nuts, and all kinds of fruit, shiny red apples, rough-skinned tangerines, bright oranges and kumquats, and sometimes a pomegranate. No mere stocking could hold such largesse. The tree was always a big one, often cut in the farm woods and heavily laden with ornaments, lights, festoons, and tinsel. Around the tree were spread all the longed-for surprises we had put on our lists to Santa. Sometimes the surprises did not live up to our hopes, especially during the war years when materials were scarce, and rubber dolls and metal carousels were not to be found. One of those years I received a note explaining the shortages and the reasons for the gifts I had not requested. Santa's handwriting, I recall, strongly resembled that of my older sister. After admiring our gifts, we'd hurry to the kitchen, where preparations had started very early. In country fashion, we feasted at midday on Christmas, or as soon thereafter as kinfolk and friends could assemble. This meant pies had to be in the oven early, freeing it for the roasting of a fresh ham or beef, or both. There's something very special about a country kitchen, especially at holiday time. Christmas morning, the bustling about of the cooks, the splendid smells and warmth, and the gaiety made it magical. Not only did activity begin early on Christmas morning, but much happened days and even weeks ahead. One big project was baking fruitcakes. This was usually done with a friend or a relative to share the work and fun and, of course, the cakes. My job each year was to pick up pecans from under the trees in the yard before the squirrels took more than their fair share. Then I had to shell the nuts. Halves were saved for decorating candies and cakes, and for salting and spicing for snacks. Broken nut meats went into cookies, candies, and cakes. Often both light and dark fruitcakes were made. Fruitcake batter, stiff with sticky citron, pecans, cherries, and other fruits, was mixed in a big bowl and forced into tube pans. Then it was baked, filling the kitchen and the entire house with a distinctive holiday aroma. When the cakes were cool, they were set in deep cake tins with wedges of apple and a generous splash of good brandy or rum. From time to time, the tins were opened to remove withered apple wedges and replace them with fresh ones, and the smell that rose from them was truly heady. After several weeks, the cakes were fully aged, ripe, moist, and delicious. I do not have the recipe for those rich cakes, although I wish I did. Like much country cooking, Mother knew how to do it by heart. Probably the cakes were never made exactly the same way twice. Christmas dinner itself was spectacular in scope, if not in sophistication, and no one was obliged to eat some of everything. There was variety to please the tastes of the many diners. There was almost always a turkey. Sometimes that rare treat, a wild turkey fattened on pine mast, the beech nuts and acorns that fell in the woods, and a pan of yellow-brown cornbread dressing. Often there was a roast beef or a fresh roast ham, too. Sometimes there was oyster stew or bisque on the stove for anyone who needed an appetizer, and always there were many dishes of vegetables, fluffy rice, and gravy, seasoned rice, homemade cucumber pickles, pickled peaches, and cranberry sauce. Sweet potatoes and Irish potatoes might both be served, and there was a lettuce-covered tray filled with celery, olives, and radishes. On a sideboard stood the cakes, pies, and candies, as well as the traditional bowl of citrusy ambrosia. It was a feast of magnitude. Today we may not fill a smokehouse with our roasts, or bake so many big fruitcakes, or hill potatoes, or serve such an overwhelming variety of food at one holiday feast. But the essence of a country Christmas remains in recipes handed down, in memories and traditions shared. If there's someone in the kitchen who loves to cook, and family or friends who enjoy good food, there can be a country Christmas anywhere. Ms. Eubanks, Thomas Catt, and the King James Grapes. Our friends all knew when the grapes were ripe. Nobody had to ask or telephone ahead. When the sunlight turned that soft gold peculiar to early autumn, friends and neighbors would appear with a bucket or basket to share in our crop of scuppernongs and King James grapes in our backyard. The vines weren't all that vast, but they were prolific every other year, in the manner of some crops. Bumper crop or slim pickings, there was always enough to share for jams and jellies, preserves, and maybe even a little homemade wine. Many people in the area had that sweet southern grape, the scuppernong. When ripe, the hull turns a lustrous bronze color, and after a rain, the heady, tantalizing, distinctive sweet smell of ripe scuppernongs would fill the air. Scuppernongs are wonderful for a pinkish jelly and dessert wine. One of my aunts also used to make scuppernong pie. Unbelievably delicious. Good as the scuppernongs were, the real attraction was the arbor of King James grapes. These grapes were a deep, almost black purple. They grew in tight, fat bunches, and their skins were tough, so they were easy to pick. At once tart and sweet, the King James grapes were prized for their excellence in preserves, jellies, and jams, and, again, wine. The pickers did not always admit they were going to make a little wine, but I am sure that grapevine supplied many a bracing nip through the long winter. It was a rare autumn when we didn't have a jug or two gurgling in the corner. The resulting wine was very sweet, but mighty good. My mother made both jelly and grape hull preserves, a family favorite. The King James grapes had a high sugar content and lots of natural pectin, so it was hard to fail in the jams and jellies enterprise. That was one reason our grapes were so popular. Besides their excellent preserving qualities, both the King James variety and the scuppernongs were fine table grapes, that is, good enough for eating right off the vine. One of our neighbors, who always came to pick a few grapes, was my mother's good friend, Ms. Eubanks, Mac. Ms. Eubanks was a very pretty woman, with soft, wavy hair and expressive dark eyes. She was always immaculately turned out, no matter what time of day. When the grapes were ripe, Ms. Eubanks would drive up and come in and chat with my mother before repairing to the vine. She would be wearing a spotless and invariably pretty print cotton dress, and often red shoes. Ms. Eubanks loved red shoes, and they were sort of a trademark of hers. Since a grape picker had to go under the arbor, Ms. Eubanks would usually bring a straw hat to protect her hair from the tendrils of the vine and any dusty fallout. Ms. Eubanks was an energetic person, and this energy sometimes manifested itself in a slight nervousness. She was, quite sensibly, afraid of snakes, and, being a good country woman, she knew that certain varieties of snakes liked to crawl up into grape arbors and rest in a perfect leafy bower on warm autumn days. No reasonable person would like to have a snake among her curly locks, no matter how harmless the snake. So Ms. Eubanks' straw hat was a carefully considered, reasonable precaution. One fine autumn day, Ms. Eubanks came to pick grapes. "Hey, Mac," my mother hallooed, "come on in for a cup of coffee before you start picking." Mac and Margaret sat a spell, rocked, chatted about children, community happenings, and the size of the grape crop this year. Pretty soon the amenities were satisfactorily concluded. Ma went back to her chores, and Ms. Eubanks tied on her straw hat and went, bucket in hand, to the grapevine down in the backyard. With some apparent trepidation, she squared her hat and ducked under the arbor to fill her bucket with bunches of the sweet grapes. Now, it's unfortunate that, of all people, it should be Ms. Eubanks who picked grapes on the very same day that Thomas Catt, a lanky tabby cat, should be napping among the leafy coolness of the arbor. Thomas Catt had appeared at our back door one day, a big-eyed kitten with a mighty meow. We took him in, of course. My father's name was Thomas, and, Since this was a little tomcat, I named him Thomas Cat, after my father, with the peculiar logic of a child. Thomas Cat and I were the best of friends in that special way that only a child and an animal can be. If we're lucky, we retain that special ability as adults. Thomas Cat grew to be a fearsome mouser, moderate traveler, and a loyal member of our family. I told him my troubles, and he listened patiently. I laughed, and he'd stretch and roll over, inviting me to scratch his belly. At the first touch, quick as lightning, he clutched my hand in all four paws in a mock fight and pretend to bite it. That meant he was happy, too. Thomas Cat was nobody's fool. He knew when and where to hunt, and which chair had the softest cushion, and he always could charm my mother out of a tidbit when she was cooking fish for dinner. He knew how to climb a tree if strange dogs were in the yard, and magically, he always seemed to know where I was. And Thomas Cat was funny and very playful, almost as though he had a sense of humor. When Miss Eubanks started reaching up into the vines, plucking bunches of grapes, Thomas Cat watched with growing interest. As her hands darted in and out, he must have decided this was some kind of game designed especially for his amusement. The cat watched her and waited until her straw hat was directly under him. Then he reached down with one paw and gave the hat a mighty swat. For good measure, in the stunned millisecond between cause and effect, he reached down, with a paw resembling a striped snake, we can imagine, and gave the bonnet another good shot. The result was electric. There was a shriek fit to rend the air to Quirrwiffle Township, and the fastest retreat I've ever seen. Miss Eubanks' shoes were a red blur as she thundered up the path, shouting, "Snake!" Her straw hat was knocked off, and the half-filled bucket summarily abandoned at the arbor. Well, to cut it short, when Miss Eubanks calmed down and realized she was not snake-bit, she and my mother made a cautious inspection of the arbor. They armed themselves with garden hose before facing the snake in the arbor. Naturally, they discovered Thomas Cat, full of mischief, curled up and waiting for another victim. Miss Eubanks had a wonderful sense of humor, so she appreciated the joke on herself more than anybody. There was unbounded laughter for a while, then great high glee and sporadic chuckling as Mac and my mother filled the bucket with King James grapes. When they came up the path to the house, they were still laughing. The bucket was full, and behind them trailed Thomas Cat. We've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Yesteryear. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Joe Simpson for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Triangle Yesteryear is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thanks for listening.
Make a wish and hear what I say. Nothing could be finer than to be in Carolina in the morning.